Welcome to the Wild Heart Meditation Center podcast. It is our intention to continue offering these audio recordings free of charge. However, if you would like to donate to support our cause and keeping our facility open in Nashville, you can do so via the Venmo app by sending a donation to @WildHeartNashville, or you can find us online at our website, wildheartmeditationcenter.org, and click the Donate tab. So tonight I want to talk about the topic of, they're sometimes called the five spiritual faculties or the five spiritual powers. They're really the seeds of awakening, the seeds of living with more awareness and more this connection to our human experience. And I'll talk about them, I'll list them here in a moment, but I want to start by doing a little bit of free association together. So checking in with yourself as I say this word, I want to see what comes up for you. And you can just say it out loud in the room, a word or two or three. What comes up for you around the word faith?
Fear.
Fear, love, connection. What is it?
Religion.
Trust.
Hope.
Church.
Deceit.
I want to read something by a lady named Sharon Salzberg. She wrote a book on faith. She's a Buddhist teacher. I feel like it's really beautiful. She says, "I want to invite a new use of the word faith, one that is not associated with a dogmatic religious interpretation or divisiveness. I want to encourage delight in the word to help reclaim faith as fresh, vibrant, intelligent, and liberating. This is a faith that emphasizes a foundation of love and respect for ourselves. It is a faith that uncovers our connection to others, rather than designating anyone as separate and apart. Faith does not require a belief system, and it is not necessarily connected to a deity or a god, though it doesn't deny one either. This faith is not a commodity that we either have or don't have. It's an inner quality that unfolds as we learn to trust our own deepest experience. The Buddha said faith is the beginning of all good things. No matter what we encounter in life, it is faith that enables us to try again, to trust again, to love again. Even in times of immense suffering, it is faith that enables us to relate to the present moment in such a way that we can go on. We can move forward instead of becoming lost in resignation or despair. Faith links our present-day experience, whether wonderful or terrible, to an underlying pulse of life itself. A capacity for this type of faith is inherent in every human being. We might not yet recognize it or know how to nurture it, but we can learn how to do both." And I really felt when she said, faith is not a commodity that we either have or don't have. It's an inner quality that unfolds as we learn to trust our own deepest experience. From a Buddhist perspective, the word faith here in the spiritual faculties comes from this root word sada in Pali Sanskrit, which actually means something more like confidence. It's the confidence that's gained through living in our integrity and from, as Sharon Salzberg says, trusting our own deepest experience. Having the confidence to know what works for us. Having the confidence to know what's fed us or helped keep us whole or connected to our values and what ways we want to live in the world. It's that faith of confidence in our integrity. I like to say, if you want to feel good, you have to do things you feel good about. right? That's kind of the basis of the Buddhist path, at least. That feeling good is on a worldly level about pleasant sights and smells and tastes and feelings and thoughts. And those things aren't bad or good or whatever. They're just pleasant. But this, the Buddha calls it unworldly pleasant. This feeling of joy or of contentment or satisfaction that we get from living in line with our values and trusting our deepest experience. As the Buddha says in this quote I'm about to read, he says that the things that we do when undertaken in practice that lead to our welfare and happiness, we should recognize and understand those and nurture those. The things that we do when undertaken in practice that lead to our welfare and happiness. And so I want to share a little bit of a story. It's a parable in the Buddha's discourses. It's called the Kalama Sutta. And it's one of my favorites, and I think it speaks really well to our cultural, and by our, I mean the American cultural common interpretations of faith, which is usually this belief-centered faith, rather than this experience-centered faith that the Buddha talks about. The word that he uses is the word ehipasiko, which means to come and see for yourself. That his teachings are an invitation to see clearly the nature of what leads to your welfare and happiness and what doesn't. And so in this sutta, it's kind of a funny story. The Buddha arrives into this town of these people called the Kalamas, and he sits on top of this hill, and everyone gathers around, and he finds out once he's up there that basically this is like, you know, the LA of the music tour circuit. Like, everyone goes through there. And a bunch of other spiritual teachers have already gone through the Kalamas, right? And so he's like getting there way late. And they go and stand around and they say, why should we believe you? Why should we even listen to you right now? There was a guy here last week saying we should worship the fire. And there was a guy here last, you know, the week before that that was saying we should do some other ritual or whatever. Why should we even listen to you? And he says, it's fitting for you to have doubt and to be perplexed. And then he says, do not go by oral traditions, by lineage of teaching, by hearsay, by a collection of scriptures, by logical reason, by inferential reasoning, by reflection on your reasons, by the acceptance of a view after pondering it, by the seeming competence of the speaker, or because you think, yeah, this person's our teacher. But instead, when you know in yourselves, these things are blamable, these things are censored by the wise, these things, if undertaken in practice, lead to harm and suffering, then you should abandon them. These things are wholesome. These things are blameless. These things are praised by the wise. These things, if undertaken in practice, lead to welfare and happiness. Then you should engage in them. Right? What are some of the things that we know in our lives that lead to our welfare and happiness? What about for you? What are some of the things that you do that lead to your welfare and happiness?
Yoga.
Gardening.
Relationships.
Yeah.
Donuts.
Sleep.
Being of service.
Giving your kids the time, yeah. He says, don't go by oral traditions, by the lineage of the teacher, by hearsay, by a collection of discourses. He says, but when you know for yourselves, this word, ehipasika, when you have seen for yourself, these things lead to my welfare and happiness, and when undertaken in practice, they benefit myself and all beings. You should practice them. Another way that faith is talked about in this spiritual practice in Buddhism is this idea of taking refuge. So why is it important to have faith? Because the Buddha says, well, if you observe this human condition, it's a vulnerable condition. We don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. So many things, most things are outside of our control. The only thing that we really have any agency over is how we relate to the changing conditions of our world, our relationship to those experiences, but that the experiences we're in are ever-changing and insecure, groundless. And so where do we rest? How do we find some refuge? The definition is a safe place to rest. Or I actually looked it up. It says a place of shelter from pursuit, danger, or trouble. How do we find some security in an insecure world? And the refuges are the refuge in they call it the triple gem, the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha. The Buddha doesn't necessarily mean the historical figure, although it can if you connect with the archetype of his story, but it means this potential that we have to wake up. How often do I remember that I have the potential to go further than the limitations of my own mind? My own self-doubt, my own self-judgments, my own comparison, that confidence in my potential. The refuge in Dharma is the refuge in, basically, it's a spiritual path. The practices of mindfulness, the practices of kindness and compassion and non-harming, these trainings that we undertake that we can take refuge in, that are pretty universal to any spiritual tradition. these values that I think we mostly universally can agree upon to take refuge in what we value, right? Like I said earlier, living in line with our integrity in a spiritual path. And that's another thing I have to remember, like on a daily basis, when I wake up, it's like consciously bringing to mind that I have some choices throughout the day. Yeah, I don't always see them because I fall into my automatic a lot of the time. And so this refuge in Dharma is this commitment to a spiritual practice. The third refuge is, like Kevin was talking about, the refuge in Sangha is community. This, what's the way that you said it? Energetic coherence. Our shared condition, the connection with other beings. The Buddha says that there are two things that lead to the arising of wisdom in your mind. Those moments of clarity that you get where they kind of rescue us from our obsessions and fears and he says that there are two things that really help you to develop those moments of clarity. Continuous awareness, developed through mindfulness, and the words of a wise friend. So we take refuge. We seek shelter in our potential, in a spiritual practice, whatever that may be. The Buddha didn't teach Buddhism. The Buddha wasn't a Buddhist. Buddha just means wake up. It literally means wake up-ism. So we take refuge in our potential to wake up, in a path that will help us, and in a community that will hold us accountable, keep us focused and connected. So this is mostly faith on experience, confidence in what has worked for us, trusting kind of our own personal experience. But I think that there's some limitations to only having faith based upon your experience. There are three things that come to mind. One is that to do anything new demands that we have a little bit of faith. Right? So if you haven't done something and you're going to do it, you don't really have the experience to have confidence in the thing. You know what I mean? You may have confidence in yourself that you can do something scary or new. That's the type of confidence we're really pointing towards. But the confidence in having had an experience is, you know, not always going to be there for us when we're trying new things. I was working with a therapy client the other day, and I've been seeing this person for a while, and to be honest, we've tried a lot of different things to tackle something that's affecting them, and I just said, yeah, I don't really know what we should do. You should just try to do something different every day. And it's kind of funny, it's humbling in a way. I was like, yeah, I don't know what we should do. I don't have the textbooks aren't going to help us on this one. You should just try something new every day. You know, do something different. When all else fails, try something you haven't tried before. And so that takes a different kind of faith, which we're going to kind of get into when we talk about the next spiritual faculty. But the other reason why we want to be careful not to rely too much on our experience is because you don't always feel connected to the faith that you've experienced, right? In times of hopelessness, in times where you feel really lost or confused or not clear, you don't feel faith in those moments. You know what I mean? So you have to garner it. You have to cultivate it outside of your own experience. And that's fucking hard to do. You know? So how do we get that type of faith sometimes when we don't feel it? I talk about this a lot in here, and I think it's one of the interesting things about the Buddha's teaching is he's not teaching a path of feeling. He's teaching a path of doing. It doesn't matter if you feel faith. It matters if you practice it. It doesn't matter if we feel like things are going to be okay, right? But we have to learn how to try to practice doing things that help us to maybe get a sense that things could be okay. Or we're headed in a direction where maybe okayness might happen. You know? We don't always feel connected to the benefits of our practice. And also, if we only settle, this is the more aspirational. This is the one that I've been really looking at lately, is if we only settle with what we've experienced, we don't look at the potential for what we could experience. So think about how much, even just rationally, we can think about, even kind of almost scientifically, how much you don't know. Like, you don't know most things. You know what I mean? And then we collectively as a human, like, don't know most things. There's a Buddhist monk, Venerable Nanda, that comes here on Friday nights. And I love sitting with him. He's been a monk since he was 9 years old. And so he's grown up in a Buddhist culture, right? And so he came in the first time he ever taught, and he talked about sending loving kindness to all beings. And he said, even the ghosts and the tree spirits. And he very nonchalantly said, just because you can't see them doesn't mean they're not there. You know, and it's not a matter of we need to believe in ghosts and tree spirits, but he's actually pointing to something different, which is we can't see everything. We can't know everything. And so if we have this kind of optimistic faith, you know, that our possibilities are far beyond the limitations of our mind, like I talked about earlier. So this is faith, one of the five spiritual powers. I'll go ahead and list the other ones right now so we know what's coming. Faith, which the Pali Sanskrit word is sada. Virya, which is effort or energy, the next spiritual power. And then there is mindfulness, sati, concentration or collectedness of mind, which is samadhi. And then there's wisdom, which is panya. So I'll just say them in English. It's faith, energy, mindfulness, stillness of mind, and wisdom, the five spiritual powers. The word virya has a lot of different translations in Pali Sanskrit. The word energy works, but also vigor, persistence, and perseverance. Right? So you see how faith is kind of a launching pad for energy. If we have this potential, you know, for awakening, and we connect with that through our experience and what's led to our welfare, you know, it enlivens a drive. The word is samvega, the spiritual urgency to act to do something. Number one thing that baffles me, I'm a therapist, so I work with people, and the number one thing that baffles me with people, myself included, why don't we do the things we know that are good for us? You know, so I said earlier, what leads to your welfare and happiness? And we named a bunch of things. So why don't we do those things? Some of them we do, right? Some of them we've committed to. So it's interesting, even in that, we can look at our life and see the ones that we do, and maybe we can get a sense of why don't we do the things that are good for us? And the answer is actually simple, but it's very hard, is because of persistence, because it takes constant practice. The Buddha talked about energy and effort more than any other topic. I've heard it said before, I don't know if this is true, that the Pali Canon is like 10 Bibles stacked on top of each other, written in the same print. So that's like an intense amount of scripture. And throughout the scriptures, the most common topic he spoke on was effort. Because what's the thing that we struggle with the most is continuing to apply ourselves to the things we know that are good for us. You know, to continue to practice. So one of my favorite quotes, if you've been coming a while, I share this every time I talk about effort, is by Maya Angelou. And she talks about this type of energy and vigor, persistence, as courage. And the word courage, the etymology of it means of the heart. So here in this quote, she says, courage is the most of all of the virtues, because without courage, you cannot practice any other virtue consistently. You can be anything erratically, kind, true, generous, fair, merciful, just, any of those things occasionally, but to be that thing time after time demands that you have courage, that you put your heart into it. You know, that we have this persistent energy to continue to do these things time and time again, especially when the going gets tough. Right? If there's one thing I've learned about a spiritual practice, it's the times when you don't feel like doing it anymore that are the most important to continue to show up. You know, they used to tell me in recovery, I'm in recovery from drug and alcohol addiction. One of the things I actually loved to hear early on is they would say, don't give up 5 minutes before the miracle happens. I used to think it was so cheesy. I got clean when I was 18. I was like, that's some fucking weird shit. I don't believe in miracles. But don't give up 5 minutes before the miracle happens. And when I actually apply that, when I've stayed a little bit longer, when I've held on a little bit longer, when I've moved through that, they call the dark night of the soul, right? When we move through those moments, you know, first of all, I think we uncover that we have had a capacity to handle a lot more than we thought we were capable of. So that faith builds, right? And also, it's usually in those moments where we see most clearly where our pain and suffering is. Our life is, you know, this body-mind is organically intelligent. You know, it will tell you where it feels pain, where it's experiencing suffering. It will show you. But we want to turn away from it. And we want to avoid it. And we want to distract from it. That's what the Buddha's calling our actual suffering. He says, yeah, that pain, that's it. That's normal. There's nothing wrong with you. You're not broken. That's it. That's how it is to be human. You know, but we live in this kind of really strange juxtaposition of a world that says that there's normal and abnormal, and there's ordered and disordered, and there's good and bad and right and wrong, and we believe that shit. Instead of, no, it's all wrong. It's not bad wrong, but it's all, it's hard. I don't know if you've noticed. It's not how it should be. You know what I mean? And that's okay. You know, that there's compassion in that. There's a shared humanity in that. So why do we give up on our spiritual practice? Why do we stop applying effort or being persistent or having courage? One of the reasons is because we feel like we're not making progress. So we kind of do this, we go to the spiritual grocery store, right? We shop around for different things that are going to be the solution to our problems. And it's hard because it's not necessarily a bad thing to seek new paths, you know, to look for different experiences that could maybe help you. But we kind of get caught in, well, I've meditated for 2 weeks and that doesn't seem to be working. So maybe I'll, you know, go chant with the Tibetan Buddhists, you know, or I'll go practice Kabbalah or whatever. You know, we kind of move around, or maybe I need to go. Not that we can use these things in conjunction, we can, but I think we give up on our practices sometimes when the going gets tough. Our routines, the habits that we're trying to build for ourselves. Right? We often judge our progress by our temporary feelings. You know, I found out that we're often doing a lot better than we're feeling. And just because it doesn't feel good doesn't mean you're doing bad. Another reason we get swept into self-doubt, right? This is the final hindrance that visited the Buddha in the mythological story of his awakening. His mind dealt him resentment and anger and blame. Then it dealt him sensual desire and lust and greed and this need to acquire and possess and have status and pleasure. And then his mind said, okay, you got through those two, but you still can't do this shit. You might as well get up. You've been sitting here 6 days now. You're crazy. Nothing's going to happen. What are you looking for? Right? And this doubt in his mind came up. And what he did is he touched the earth. This is this kind of mudra, this symbol, which is symbolic, where he says, basically, this is my birthright. Basically, I'm already awake. You're just my mind. And he said, I see you, Mara, which is this kind of negative aspect of our mind, the part of our mind that can derail us in self-doubt and greed and hatred. And all he said is, I see you. I see you, doubt. There you are again. It's just doubt. It's just a mind state. We also lose focus. We don't implement our spiritual practice as a daily routine. That's another one. It's like we like this. This is good. It feels good. It fits. We connect to it. But meditate at home? Nah, I ain't got time for that. You know, so we can ease into our practices, right? 5 minutes. Can you sit your butt down for 5 minutes? Observe your mind. Be kind to yourself. You know, what if we scheduled time to be kind to ourselves? You got 5 minutes, 10 minutes every day. All you got to do is just be present, try to be kind to whatever comes up. So Maya Angelou says, to be that thing time and time again demands that you have courage. And the emphasis here is being that thing time and time again, doing these things time and time again. So the last thing I'll share on energy real quick, a lot of people have heard this story, but it was huge for me. It was a moment of clarity that I had where I was at a retreat center in Myanmar, used to be called Burma, where a lot of our spiritual tradition comes from. And I was on a meditation retreat for a month. Silent meditation retreat. You wake up at 3 in the morning, you go to bed around 10 at night, and you meditate an hour durations, sitting and walking, for the entire day, other than the two meals you have. And so their whole emphasis there is effort. Mindfulness, every moment, every possible moment. What's happening? Note what's happening. Notice what's happening every moment. And so the first day I got there, I was jet lagged as hell, flew into Myanmar, completely disoriented, get to this retreat center. The people, when I arrive, they don't speak English. They give me a key. I go into this room. I think I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. I have no clue. Show up to the meditation hall. I just start sitting the schedule for like 4 or 5 hours. Comes to 8 o'clock at night, the last sit of the night. last meditation. So it's an hour long. And I thought, you know, I've been traveling. It's been a long time, long day. I think I'm going to go hit the hay, go back to my room. And so I start walking back, and there's this monk that's pacing at the end of the pathway. And I turn on my mindfulness, and I'm slowly walking. And I kind of, like, tiptoe around him, you know, like when you're trying to sneak out of the house when you're a kid. And I was, like, walking, and he goes, like, literally my worst fear, I hear him go, "Excuse me." And I look up and I look at him and he says, "Where are you going?" And he had this really sweet, like, his English accent actually made his voice very sweet. It's like very kind. And he goes, "Where are you going?" And I said, "Oh, I'm going back to my kuti to go to sleep. I've had a long day, just got here." And he said, "Oh, no." And he looked at his watch and he goes, "Meditation time." And I looked at him and I said, "No, I know." You know, I thought that maybe he didn't understand that I knew that. And I was like, "Yeah, I know, but I'm going to go back to my kuti and go to sleep." And he looked at me and he put his hands like this and he looked right into my eyes and he said, "Please try. Please try." And I was like, "Fuck." This was my first day on this retreat. And I was like, "Damn." And what I felt in that moment was actually this, like, crazy feeling, like he knew that I had it in me. He knew that I had more in me than I, in that moment, would believe in myself. And so I turned around and I went back and I sat. I basically fell asleep the whole time, right? But I had a few more moments of mindfulness. Faith, energy, concentration. So I like to switch the order. I'm going to kind of talk about these last three together because they tend to go together, which is concentration or stillness of mind, mindfulness, and wisdom. The word for concentration is samadhi, and what it means is a collectedness of mind. One of the first things that we develop in having a meditation practice is the ability to ignore our mind. Not that the whole point of mindfulness is to ignore your mind, but we have to learn how to detach from our mental preoccupation. Our attention is addicted to thinking. A thought arises into the mind, the attention says, "Oh, what's that thought? I'm going to go with that thought." Then the next thought comes up and the attention says, "Oh, what's that thought? I got to go with that thought." The mind has this urgency to it, this kind of seductive nature. It seduces our attention away from what's actually happening in the moment. So our attention is caught up in thought, consumed in thought. There's this discourse. In Zen Buddhism, they call this the monkey mind. And the Buddha talks about this a little bit in this discourse. He says, "There are in the Himalayas, the king of mountains, level stretches of land that are delightful, where both monkeys and human beings wander." Can you imagine being in such a place? "In such spots, hunters set a tar trap in the monkeys' tracks in order to catch some of the monkeys. Those monkeys who are not foolish or careless by nature, when they see the tar trap, they avoid it from afar. But any monkey who is foolish and careless by nature comes up to the tar trap and grabs it with its paw. He gets stuck there, thinking, 'I'll free my paw.' So he grabs it with his other paw, thinking, 'I'll free both my paws.' He grabs it with his foot, thinking, 'I'll free both my paws and my foot.' He grabs it with his other foot. He gets stuck there, thinking, 'I'll free both of my paws and my feet as well.' He grabs it with his mouth. He gets stuck there. So the monkey, snared in five ways, lies there whimpering, having fallen to misfortune, fallen on ruin, a prey to whatever the hunter wants to do with him." This is the monkey mind. A thought comes up during the meditation, and it's a good one. It's a plan for tomorrow. It's something we forgot to do last week. So we say, "Well, I think I'll just have a think for a second. I'll sit down and figure this one out." Or a creative song idea. or a really great insight. Oh, wow. And so we get caught up in this swinging from vine to vine, thinking and thinking and thinking. And one of the first practices we learn in mindfulness is to disobey the mind. To say, hey, thanks for sharing, not to have a negative relationship to the mind, but to see the mind and say, not right now. And to focus on what we talked about tonight, our anchor, the breath, the sounds, the body. And through this practice, you can actually start to develop this continuity of focus. And your mind will become more tranquil, more peaceful, less scattered, less preoccupied. Now, if you sit down to meditate one time and your mind's scattered and restless, yeah, that's the environment of the mind. That's about how it should be. If you're meditating every day, you know, or starting to develop a practice, you'll notice your mind will become a little bit more still. And with that, stillness opens up more awareness, mindfulness. In some ways, mindfulness can be talked about as the absence of absent-mindedness, right? This present awareness. So where do we usually leave when we get caught up in our thoughts? We leave right here. You know, we get pulled into the future, the fear, the worry, the expectation, the anticipation that fuels and feeds our anxiety, which feeds more thoughts, which feeds more anxiety, which feeds this neurotic trying to do and figure it out and endless habit. Or we get caught in the past, the regret, or the what I call the coulda, shoulda, woulda, I could have done or should have done or wish I would have done. And so mindfulness is this kind of remembering that we're here. It's like, oh yeah, shit, I'm here. But it's also sometimes referred to as this watcher and protector of the mind. So also being able to have more than just present awareness, what they call introspective awareness. You can look into your own mind in the moment and observe its current state, its mood, its attitude, its the longing, the craving, like I said tonight during the instruction, the wanting or the not wanting. You know, that part of the mind that is always thinking that our life is going to be better just right around the next corner. Or if only I had certain things in my life, then I'd be happy. Or I'd rather be somewhere else or with someone else. Or the fantasies, the future, the past. We're actually able to protect our mind a little bit and to say, hey, man, it's cool. Not judging you, but like we're here right now. And let's maybe just let that go for now. Mindfulness also helps us to notice our mental patterns, or the different stories that we tell about ourselves. Brené Brown calls it the inner hustler. Comparing, competing, proving, predicting, outperforming. You know, all those strategies the mind does to try to keep us better than and smarter and more attractive. And, you know, it gets caught in the you know, what's good and bad, what's right and wrong, what's normal and abnormal, in that linear world. So mindfulness can start to arise when our mind becomes a little bit more still. The good news is even if you don't meditate, one of the things that can help your mind become still, the Buddha talked about, is what you do, your behaviors, the people you surround yourself with, the things you consume and take in. So there are a lot of ways that we can get started. If you're like, I'm not going to go meditate for 30 minutes tomorrow, all right, fine. Just maybe look at some of the things that spin you out, you know? And then through these practices, right, all of this, through faith, through energy, through still mind, through mindfulness, we develop wisdom. Wisdom are these moments of clarity, the fruits of our practice that arise from having faith, from applying ourselves to a goal, a spiritual practice, a path, through quieting our mind, disengaging from some of the disruptive thoughts, from watching our mind, we develop wisdom. So I want to read this quote and then open it up for group discussion. How's the temperature in here? Is it hot? Would someone switch it over to the AC? It's a hard thing about this time of year. It's using my mindfulness of other people to see everyone's fucking hot as shit, aren't they? So you'll just switch all the way on the side down to cool? Or up to cool or whatever?
Yeah.
And then that should probably be good. There it goes.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. So I'll read this quote. This is about wisdom. It is the first pages of this really wonderful book by a Buddhist scholar and monk named Bhikkhu Bodhi. It's literally the first words of the entire book on the Eightfold Path. This is what he says. The search for a spiritual path is born out of suffering. It does not start with lights and ecstasy, but with the hard tracks of pain, disappointment, and confusion. However, for suffering to give birth to a genuine spiritual search, it must amount to more than something passively received from without. It has to trigger an inner realization, a perception which pierces through the facile complacency of our usual encounter with the world to glimpse the insecurity perpetually gaping underfoot. When this insight dawns, even if only momentarily, it can precipitate a profound personal crisis. It overturns accustomed goals and values, mocks our routine preoccupations, leaves old enjoyment stubbornly unsatisfying. At first, such changes generally are not welcome. We try to deny our vision and to smother our doubts. We struggle to drive away the discontent with new pursuits. But the flame of inquiry, once lit, continues to burn, and if we do not let ourselves be swept away by superficial readjustments or slouch back into a patched-up version of our natural optimism, eventually the original glimmering of insight will again flare up, again confront us with our essential plight. It is precisely at that point, with all escape routes blocked, that we are ready to seek a way to bring our disquietude to an end. No longer can we continue to drift complacently through life, driven blindly by our hunger for sense pleasures and by the pressure of prevailing social norms. A deeper reality beckons us. We have heard the call of a more stable, more authentic happiness, and until we arrive at our destination, we cannot rest content. It's Bhikkhu Bodhi. That was my experience. It's not everyone's experience. I came to this path out of suffering, out of disquietude, as he says, out of desperation. It's a great motivator. When I didn't have faith and I didn't have energy, I had desperation, which will give you those two things, right? So they say, Ajahn Chah says, there are two types of suffering. There's the suffering that leads to more suffering, and the suffering that leads to the end of suffering. If you're unwilling to embark on the second, you're sure to repeat the first.